This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I think there's an attempt to take up punitive action against South Africa. You know, this sort of axis of evil notion that is very much part of the political culture.
That's Naledi Pandor, South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, on negative reaction to Pretoria, accusing Israel of committing genocide actions in Gaza. Details coming up. Also, Cameroon's government threatens to arrest opposition parties, and Gambia's parliament moves to repeal its ban on female genital mutilation. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. U.S. President Joe Biden spoke Monday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the first time in more than a month, voicing new concerns about Israel's war against Hamas and its plan for a ground attack on the Gaza city of Rafah near the Egyptian border. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan called Netanyahu's plan for smashing into Rafah a big mistake. At Biden's request, Sullivan said Netanyahu agreed to send a team of Israeli officials to Washington to discuss the Rafah attack plans and safeguards for about 1 million Palestinians sheltering there. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed the development with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
It was their 20th phone call, which Biden gave a State of the Union address a little over a week ago, when Biden said that what Netanyahu was doing was against the interests of Israel. But it took until now for them to talk, which is kind of shocking to me. Another thing was going on during that month, though, which is that Israel had been paused in part from pressure from the United States on new forms of kinetic action, that they had done major operations in the north and center of Gaza, but not in the south, because the U.S. had sort of boxed them in. On the one side, the U.S. was pressuring Israel towards a temporary ceasefire, which the U.S. stated many times they hoped would convert to a permanent ceasefire, or they had to present a civilian protection plan for an invasion of Rafah, which Israel never produced, and the U.S. wasn't going to support Israel during that operation the way that they had been supporting it before if there wasn't protections in place to protect civilians, which Israel never did properly. So the frustration was growing privately and publicly over the 5 months as Israel kept failing to protect civilians. And so the heightened level of disappointment slowly has become a level of alarm now. So now we're at the point where Biden's saying Netanyahu is working against the interests of Israel. It's the worst I've seen in my lifetime between a U.S. and Israeli heads of state, that they're publicly criticizing them to this level. And don't forget that Netanyahu is criticizing the United States quite vehemently in the Israeli press, as the U.S. president's making unprecedented statements against an Israeli head of state. So this is the level of almost a diplomatic crisis in terms of the dynamics between the new men. In this case, Biden, who's a self-declared Zionist, actively saying Netanyahu's bad for the Zionist cause, bad for Israel. And we've now had over 20,000 civilian non-combatants killed at a pace worse than Rwanda. Worse than anything we've seen since World War II. This has been called genocidal by the International Court of Justice. It's all being done with U.S. weapons, logistical support, and diplomatic cover. So the U.S. should be outraged, and there need to be more changes probably to bring this war to an end.
White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan called Netanyahu's plan for a ground offensive smashing into Rafah a mistake. At Biden's request, Sullivan said Netanyahu agreed to send a team of Israeli officials to Washington in the coming days to discuss Israel's plan for any attack on Rafah and safeguards of Palestinian sheltering there. How could that impact the rising rift between the two countries?
So the visit absolutely has to happen because of the rift. The Israelis are paying lip service to what the American concerns are, but now they need to prove that their actions will meet their words. The Americans in those meetings will try to convince the Israelis to do surgical strikes, not unlike the American and Iraqi operations in Mosul against ISIS. The Israelis will try to convince the Americans that this death rate of killing two civilians for every alleged Hamas fighter is a good ratio, and they can be much more aggressive than what the Americans have been advising. These are arguments that keep falling flat with the Americans, which is why we haven't really had that southern operation yet. Americans are insisting that the 1.5 million civilians that were forced to Rafah, most of them, need to be protected. They can't go back to the north, which is what Israel wants to do, which has been made unlivable. There's no housing there. There's no fresh water. There's now famine conditions in the north. The center was also made unlivable during the Israeli operations there. And what went wrong during that period was they were making these sort of micro havens for Israelis to move to and then hitting some of those havens. And so that failed, which is one of the reasons why everyone ended up in Rafah and this war sort of came to sort of a pause because Israeli civilian protection systems were failing. The U.S. agrees on defeating Hamas, but doesn't believe it needs to be done this way. The term we hear a lot is surgical. So how do you defeat Hamas? Netanyahu says they're down to four brigades. Now he's saying there's a brigade and a half in the center. I don't know if that's on top of the four. He said we're in the south from the original 24 Hamas brigades. So we have to do something with the 1.5 million people in and around Rafah, but we also have to do something with the other 800,000, at least half of whom are in famine conditions, starving to death.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Naledi Pandor, South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, is visiting Washington largely to meet with members of Congress and civil society. At an event yesterday at the South African Embassy, VOA asked about the U.S.-South Africa relationship since Pretoria accused Israel of committing genocide actions in Gaza at the U.N.'s International Court of Justice, ICJ. In addition, some members of the U.S. Congress are considering a re-evaluation of the relationship, in part because of South Africa's close ties with China and Russia.
I think there's an attempt to take up punitive action against South Africa. You know, this sort of axis of evil notion that is very much part of the political culture.
This month, South Africa requested additional measures from the ICJ, accusing Israel of weaponizing starvation by preventing humanitarian aid from reaching Gaza since the war began in October. Israel's government has denounced the case. The White House told VOA in January that it was meritless. Pandor has said she intends to remind members of Congress of the value of South Africa on its own and as a gateway to the continent. She said her government thinks any action to diminish the bilateral relationship would be most unwise.
Because these are two key democracies in the region in which we exist, and I believe that the relationship between the United States and South Africa can help to promote peace and democracy on the African continent and also to support the agenda of development in Africa. Because I can't imagine how initiatives directed at greater trade and development would become operational if institutional capacity of South Africa is not utilized.
South Africa is a major beneficiary of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which offers access to U.S. markets to 32 African nations. Pandor, a veteran member of the ruling African National Congress Party, stressed that Pretoria's problem is not with the White House. She told VOA she was not seeking meetings with either President Joe Biden or Secretary of State Antony Blinken during her visit. Asked by VOA whether the high-stakes diplomatic pushback has been worth it, Pandor said she drew on lessons from South Africa's history.
What I do know is there's a struggle underway, and the longer you take to address the demands of a struggle, the more violent and vicious the struggle becomes. So the sooner you address peace and negotiations, the greater the opportunity for everybody to enjoy peace and security. This is the lesson of South Africa.
VOA's Carol Van Dam prepared this report along with material from VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell, who was at the South African Embassy yesterday. Unidentified youths shot dead 15 people in South Sudan's Pibor region, including its commissioner, as he was returning from a visit to a village yesterday. The information minister of Greater Pibor Administrative Area says the ambush also killed the commissioner's bodyguard and government officials. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. India will bring in and prosecute 35 Somali pirates its navy captured on a hijacked ship off Somalia. Reuters says the move is a departure from its recent practice of rescuing vessels and crew, but leaving the disarmed pirates at sea. An official told the news service that the captured pirates are due to arrive in India on Saturday and will be handed over to the law enforcement agencies. The exact charges they will face were not immediately clear. Indian Navy commandos managed to release the Malta-flagged commercial ship MV Ruin on Saturday, which had been hijacked 450 nautical miles east of Socotora in the northern Arabian Sea by Somali pirates on December the 14th. Gambia's parliament has moved to repeal the country's ban on female genital mutilation. The measure passed by a vote of 42-4. It fully enacted, Gambia would be the first country to reverse legal protection against FGM for millions of women and girls. Amnesty International says passing the bill would set a dangerous precedent for women's rights and tarnish Gambia's human rights record. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Honorable members, the results of your votes. Those in favor, 4-2, 42. Those not in favor, 4. Abstention, 1. The ayes have it.
Gambian lawmakers have voted overwhelmingly in favor of repealing a 2015 ban on female genital mutilation, which protected millions of women and girls from the practice. Supporters of the bill argue that the ban was stopping them from practicing the cultural and religious obligation that allows young girls and women to go through the practice. The World Health Organization says the practice has no benefit. Lawmaker Elmame Kiba introduced a bill which caught 42 votes. 4 lawmakers voted against it and 1 abstained.
This bill seeks to lift the ban on female circumcision in the Gambia, a practice deeply rooted in ethnic, traditional, cultural and religious belief of majority of Gambian people. The bill seeks to uphold religious plurality and safeguard cultural norms and values.
The plan to change the law has been met with criticism from women, activists and rights groups who say the lifting of the ban will hurt years of progress in protecting and empowering women and girls. Michelle Ikin is a senior researcher with Amnesty International's West and Central Africa office. She says allowing the practice of FGM back in the Gambian community is dangerous.
It's disheartening that after such a long fight for women's rights and the advance in 2015 to have a ban against female genital mutilation, we have this huge setback. It would be completely disastrous for women's rights. It took almost 10 years to get the first conviction against female genital mutilation. And now we are basically telling young girls that their rights can be easily chipped away.
UN data indicates the prevalence of FGM in the West African nation has fallen since former President Yahya Jammeh banned the practice in 2015. It is punishable by up to 3 years of imprisonment. The bill will go to a committee before returning to Parliament for a third reading. Speaking to the local media after the bill was passed, Giba said they would fight to uphold the ban.
We will make sure that it's about the people, and the bill is about the people for the people, and the people will stay in their processes. When it goes to national consultation, whatever the determining factor is, we will take it that people decide. So we will not sit in a corner at a comfort zone and we make judgment on our own.
Eken hopes the parliament committee will give victims of FGM the platform to understand why the ban should remain.
To the special committee consulting people, to talk, to speak to young girls who went through that and have serious complications, to speak to the family, to the sisters who lost their young ones because they died, they bled to death after female genital mutilation. I'll ask them to, instead of, to be fair, to include not only activists that are against female genital mutilation, but to talk to women and young girls who suffered because of that.
The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says at least 30 million women globally have undergone FGM in the past 8 years. For the 1.36 million women and girls in Gambia who face the danger of the practice, their hope lies with the parliamentary committee, which will be tasked with studying the bill before returning it to the parliament for a third reading. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
A report by the World Meteorological Organization presents an ominous picture of what lies ahead for Earth if urgent action is not taken to stop what appears to be an inevitable march towards surpassing a key global warming threshold. The WMO's State of Global Climate report issued yesterday in Geneva, Switzerland, said 2023 was the hottest year on record, with carbon dioxide levels 50% higher than the pre-industrial era. Celeste Saolo, WMO's Secretary General, said she is sounding the red alert because the long life of CO2s in the atmosphere means temperatures will continue to rise. She pointed out a glimmer of hope with renewable energy surging. Crop failures this year mean many Zimbabweans are facing hunger. In some villages across the country, people are standing in line to receive life-saving handouts of grain, peas, and cooking oil. The crisis has also been exacerbated by an El Niño-induced drought that has hit many southern African nations. Elliot Masote, professor of business at DeVry University in the U.S. state of Ohio, acknowledges El Niño's effect on the harvest, but blames the government for not stepping up.
We see that there's climate change, and this year in Zimbabwe and other southern African countries, there's an El Niño that is really, I think, the worst that has ever been seen. You know, highest temperatures in Zimbabwe going all the way to about, you know, 45 degrees, just like in the desert. So almost all crops are dry, and people have nothing to eat. But we can blame climate change, but on a greater part, I would want to blame the government, because they knew this was coming. And these type of weather patterns are not new to, you know, Zimbabwe. They are not new to Africa. They are not new to the world as well. So for us to see that there are at least 7 million people who are running short of food in Zimbabwe when the government is there, we start to question the government and put doubts on exactly what type of government can let that happen in a country that has a bumper harvest last year and the year before. So why couldn't they prepare for that? And now they are talking about importing a genetically modified grain to sell to people in Zimbabwe. But we have to remember, people don't have money to buy with such a high unemployment rate of up to 80%. The poverty is going to increase. People are going to starve. And that must not be accepted if a government that calls itself a government is there.
But Professor, let's go back a little in history. 2000, when former President Robert Mugabe seized white-owned farms, disrupting, you know, the production and leading to sharp falls in output, leaving many Zimbabweans reliant on food aid for survival. So the problem even goes further than this government, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it goes further than, this government. But then we have to remember that this government, people in this government, they were part of the previous government. We know President Mnangagwa was part of, you know, the former President Robert Mugabe's government from 1980. So the blame can still carry over. The land invasion that happened, land distribution that happened in a very haphazard way that disrupted everything, it was still the same political party that was in power, the same individuals that are in power today which means the same individuals that must take the blame and the same individuals that must prepare for people not to starve.
I remember Professor Zimbabwe being breadbasket of Southern Africa, and to find itself now in this kind of a situation, how can it be reversed? What should the government do?
Yeah, I would give the government advice to make sure they're going to teach people, you know, methods of preserving their grain, because we know the past 2 years there have been bumper harvesters, and this year people are starving. You know, what happened to all the excess food that they had last year? Because people don't have preservation methods that they have. And also the other thing is that people must be taught to, you know, plant drought-resistant crops, small grains, and know how to preserve them. Because only, you know, knowing how to plant them and not knowing how to preserve them for a long term, it's not going to help. So education is really key, all the way from primary to universities, and investing in that as well, so that people will know that, well, this is going to be the new normal of having frequent droughts. What should we do? And, you know, people always look forward to the government to teach them, you know, to lead them on the best ways to preserve their grain and what to also grow and also share all that among, you know, people.
That was Elliot Masote, professor of business at DeVry University. He spoke to me from the U.S. state of Ohio.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week, right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Ethiopia's biggest bank is reportedly trying to recover more than $40 million after a technical glitch allowed customers to withdraw more money than they had in their accounts. Local media told the Associated Press that long lines formed at cash machines across Ethiopia on Saturday after the problem was discovered at the Commercial Bank of Ethiopia. The bank's CEO said news of the glitch was spread on social media by university students who withdrew much of the money. The bank has not said how much was withdrawn, but its CEO told reporters that 500,000 transactions were made during the glitch. A local newspaper reported that $42 million was lost.
VOA. VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
Your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Justin Twait, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.